Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain sensing headband that helps you meditate, and from Meditation Studio, the five-star app. I'm Patricia Karpus. Today's guest is Sarah Stein Greenberg, the author of a new book called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. A quote from the inside cover sums it up. In an era of ambiguous, messy problems, as well as extraordinary opportunities for positive change, it's vital to have both an inquisitive mind and the ability to act with intention. This book is filled with ways to build those skills with resilience, care, and confidence. Sarah is the executive director of Stanford's D-School, or Design School, and the tools and exercises in the book are a gift to the rest of us who've not yet had the opportunity to go through their programs, designed to spark creativity, foster connection, and solve problems. I am hooked on their work. Now, here's Sarah. Sarah, it is great to have you on Untangle today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, I loved your book. It's so different. On our show, we cover a lot of different topics ranging from mindfulness to neuroscience to leadership to anxiety and depression, and this idea of creative acts for curious people and how to really think creatively and lead in unconventional ways. It's so delightful to be thinking about this, and your book was just fun to read. So I want to start with learning a little bit more about you. Maybe even you as a 10-year-old. What were you like as a 10-year-old, and what inspired your creativity?
That is a great question. That really takes me back. So as a 10-year-old, I was already someone who liked to make things. I think at that point, I had already had my first camera. My dad is a photographer, and he started me out early, and I would go around the neighborhood and photograph icicles or interesting trees that actually probably weren't that interesting, but I thought they were interesting. And just starting to adopt that photographer's way of looking at the world. How might this look through a lens if I try to create an image? What could that be? I was also kind of a serious kid. I read a lot. And I liked to disappear into books. I had a really active imagination. And those are definitely some of the defining characteristics. I attended a summer camp, and one of my counselors really said, "Hey, you really carry the weight of the world on your shoulders. You can lighten up sometimes, kid."
Oh,
I was like, yeah, she's right. But also, she really gets who I am. But I do have this very, very playful side. And I think that comes out a lot in my love of games and also just the ways in which I love to engage outdoors with the natural world. And I think all of those things really have their foundation. And 10-year-old, that's a good moment in time. I can see that a lot of those traits really were starting to crystallize around then.
Yeah. And in the book, I think you said you were obsessed with Peter Pan. What was that about?
Sometimes I think children just gravitate towards certain stories and certain parts of your imagination just get fired up. I think there was something for me that was, I read the book, so I wasn't actually a big fan of the various Peter Pan movies, but I read the original novel at least once a year for many years as a child. I think it, for me, it was like this idea of this faraway place, one, of course, that you could fly to, that was very exciting, but two, that was all about the society run by children. And there was something to me about the idea of establishing your own society, your independence, your codes of conduct and your rules and your norms and your ways of engaging and playing and being a part of the world with a group of other kids, that I think that was really part of it that really fired up my imagination.
It makes so much sense, since you said you had this predestined active imagination. And I want to understand all about the D-School. But tell us first your definition of design. And then let's get into what is the D-School for some of our listeners who haven't heard of it yet.
That sounds great. I think about design as really a very flexible and useful way of solving and approaching problems. And a lot of us, I think, are initially trained to think design is about just the aesthetics or just the finishing touches on an object, or interior design is like how you might arrange the different things in relationship in your house, how to make it beautiful, how to make it elegant. And those things are absolutely a part of the wide world of design. But over time, design has evolved to be this set of practices and ways of working that can be applied in just about any space and any challenge where creativity is useful. And one of the core elements of design that I think is really just useful to anyone, no matter what field they're in, no matter where they are thinking about solving challenges, is that we think about not just creating something, making a solution, but also about how do we figure out what is the problem that is worth working on? And so at the D School, we talk about design as a relationship between both problem solving and problem finding or problem framing. At the D School, which is an institute at Stanford, we're kind of a crossroads at the university. And we teach classes to students from all over. So students might be majoring in engineering, or they might be getting a business degree. They might even be in medical school or the law school. Those students are all coming together and taking classes and really being challenged then to work in a very interdisciplinary environment with other students who might not think in similar ways. And we take them through a set of experiences of working on real projects that have no one right answer, and asking them to apply their creative skills and use design to figure out how they might create a better experience for teachers in a particular school context, or how they might create a better experience for patients or doctors in a healthcare environment. And the field of design, as I said, has just continued to evolve and expand and is now being used to tackle opportunities in all of these different places.
I love this quote from the book. When you talk about design, it can take you on a journey to learn not just how to solve a problem, but also how to identify what problem might be so worth solving that you reorganize your life around the endeavor. You talk about the fact that when is it a solution has an emotional component at its core, it is much more powerful.
That's right. And that is because, in particular, we specialize in what's often called human-centered design. So as opposed to, I think a lot of new ideas come to the world in part because there's a new technology available and someone wants to figure out like, oh, how could we apply this in different ways? We actually really always start with the idea that the humans who are involved in whatever context you're designing for, you really need to understand and pay attention to those needs. And that's often where you find those opportunities, those problems worth working on and worth, in some cases, changing your trajectory around. And I'll give you an example that I go into detail in the book. But we had a team of students and they were this interdisciplinary mix. So two medical students and a civil engineer and a policy student. They were working together on a team with a partner who was a cardiac care hospital in South India. And the students were there to really help design ways to help this hospital further its mission, which was around providing low cost, but very high quality healthcare at a large scale. So the students went in thinking, okay, the solutions are probably around reducing the cost of some of the operations, or helping with patient flow, or helping create some kind of efficiency. And what they noticed when they were doing their research and really doing interviews and observing and tuning into those human needs is that there was a whole population of folks who were not seen as part of the equation. And those were the family members of patients who were waiting for long periods in the hospital. And those people were really under stress. They had a lot of anxiety. They were not getting as much information as they wanted about what was happening with their family member who was undergoing surgery. And the students just couldn't stop thinking about that very human, very emotional set of needs. And so ultimately, in the problem framing and problem defining work that they did, they realized, yeah, there's some other opportunities around cost or efficiency, but we really want to try to address the needs that these patients' family members are having. And they wound up designing this really elegant, very low cost approach of providing family members with a little bit of basic healthcare training so that they can really be an active part of taking care of people once they return home from the hospital. And what's extraordinary is that this solution has been shown to reduce the rate of hospital readmissions, reduce complications after surgery. And the students went on to reorient their careers around this. They launched an organization called Nura Health, which is just doing incredible work all over South Asia. So that is a great example of where, because the students got to spend time thinking about what is the problem that we really want to solve here, and they gravitated towards those very powerful human emotions, they wound up creating something that it was a problem lying in plain sight that no one else was working on. So it's a really powerful thing to be able to tap into those emotional needs.
How do your students have access to engaging the way those students did, which is so amazing and makes so much sense, because once you experience something, you can't turn away in a way if you're empathic at all. And how do your students, do you encourage them to go into the field to actually engage with the problem that they're trying to solve?
It's a great question. Yeah. So we do really require that students get out of the classroom and off campus and actually engage directly with the people that they might be designing for, and oftentimes designing with. And that is what gives them that primary data, that sensitivity. And then we also train them. We train them around empathy and how to lead an interview that's not the very clinical, like, yes, no, do you ever experience fear or anxiety? Yes, no. It's really about asking the people open-ended questions, listening to their stories, trying to make sense of them, often like with the person themselves, about, hey, what does this mean to you? What is this experience? How has this affected you? And that's where you start to surface some of those emotions. And I love that you said, once you see those, you can't turn away from them, because I have seen that happen many times where, and these are very brainy, very intellectual students, but once they really start to notice some of these underlying more human needs, they develop a real sense of urgency and they feel a sense of real obligation. Wow, no one else is paying attention to this set of needs. I want to design something for that. I really want to try to help at least improve the situation for these people that I've met.
It's so interesting, because once you hear someone's story, everything changes, but most people don't stop long enough to do that deep listening. So it's interesting that this is part of a curriculum. You talk a lot about dealing with ambiguity and uncertainty and ways to get unstuck. How would you apply some of these tools for people who might be personally stuck in their lives, especially now with so much that has changed in our world and our environment, and people may be unsure of what to do next in their lives? What tools or exercises or wisdom from design thinking would you apply?
I relate to what you're saying. This is a moment when so many of us are going through these kinds of unprecedented challenges. And it's easy to get stuck. It's easy to really feel like, wow, we've been working under challenging conditions and it's not done. And how's the world going to look tomorrow? I will say one of the ways that I think design is really relevant and helpful is because it fundamentally is a process where you develop the skills to confront unexpected challenges and to improvise your way forward with the creative skills that you have. One of the things that we talk about in design is the balance between action and reflection. They have to work together. So when you might do an interview, you might learn something, and then you need to like really reflect on it and figure out, what does that mean? How does that help me figure out what direction to move in? And at the same time, if you just get stuck thinking about just thinking or observing or reflecting, and you don't take action and say, oh, let me try to design a solution, I'm going to test it and see how it works, you can often get stuck as well. So one lesson that people can extract is, hey, am I in a process of reflection or action right now? Do I need to maybe do the other one? What if I spent an hour, I've been working. What if I took an hour and really reflected on what the past year has been like? There is a great assignment in the book that there are actually several wonderful reflection-oriented assignments. One of them is called What, So What, Now What? Which sounds really simple, and it is. It's just a disciplined process of really saying, hey, I'm going to reflect on that experience. What happened? What does that mean to me? That's the so what. And then the now what? What do I want to do with that? And I think just that the simplicity of breaking apart those three parts of diagnosing or understanding your experience is, it just helps it be less overwhelming. So that's one of those tools that one of our faculty, Leticia Britos Cavagnaro, developed with her class. It's disarmingly powerful. That's one that I like a lot.
I love that. And I also think it's so interesting that you talked about yourself, this balance between heaviness and playfulness, because I think that is true sometimes with action and reflection in many of us. So I love that balance of reflection and then action and playfulness.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you one of my favorite assignments in the book that's really playful is one that's called First Date, Worst Date.
Oh, I saw that.
Yeah. Our director of teaching and learning, Carissa Carter, developed this and it's really fun. It's really fun to do. I mean, you could even do it at a party, but you basically just ask everybody to use Legos to build a representation of their worst first date. And everybody has a story around this theme. And then when you have to build it in Legos, it forces people to have to get creative. So some people might make a representation of an interaction, or somebody might make like a thing that represents their feelings, like falling off a cliff or something, hopefully not literal to that first date experience. But there's something that the act of building an idea, an abstract idea, is a form of taking action. And if you do that right before you need to then go give a big presentation or build something more complex or get out of that reflective mode, those are the kinds of things that design helps us do. And there's actually a name for it. We call it thinking with things. And it's a different way of engaging your brain to work through a problem or a process. So that's one that if you're already have a strong reflective practice, that's a great example of one of the assignments that could really help you start to build up your action orientation.
That's a really fun example. There's some dialogue in the book about limiting beliefs and mindsets that are fixed. And I really liked what you were saying about what happens when someone feels like they're such an expert that they roll their eyes at every new idea. What does one do with someone like that?
Well, I have found that if you can persuade that person to go with you to interview someone who is a different type of a stakeholder, even in the ecosystem that they are very familiar with, that can be surprisingly eye-opening. And I had that experience once many years ago with a guy who was the head of research science at a large company that made all kinds of healthcare products. And we did a little field trip with his team where we just went to a drugstore and we interviewed people about what they were purchasing and why they were purchasing it. And he was really skeptical. He was, "I know all about research. I'm an expert in research. Here are all my degrees to prove it." He was very hesitant to go along. And he hung back and he just observed as I and another team member really started engaging people. And he saw a whole other side to how real consumers, in that case, were interacting with the products that he was making. And it just was enough to help open his eyes to the idea that he is an expert in certain things, but not in everything. And it was this little window. And I find that it's even helpful when, for example, like two team members are disagreeing about what's the direction we should go, my solution, your solution, just sharing those different ideas and testing them with people who might actually be the end users of those, it breaks that stalemate. It introduces new data and it helps everybody orient again towards those underlying human needs rather than your own beliefs about what the right solution might be. So we do take this posture of humility in human-centered design of really trying to assume, like, I know a lot about how to make things, I know a lot about how to interpret things, but I'm not actually usually the person that we're designing this thing for. I really need to listen.
That's great. And so that's the limited mindset or the expert mindset. What about, and you have this assignment that focuses on this, those of us that share our brains with our inner critic? How do we move forward with that? Like 70% of our brains are filled with the inner critic. I hope it's not that much.
Yeah, I know. Some days it really does feel like the inner critic has taken up a lot of real estate in there. I'll say a few things about that. I think one of the keys to that is really to locate your inner critic. what is your inner critic actually saying to you? And actually, the very first assignment in the book is called Blind Contour Portraits. And there's a long history of using these in many art teachers. We use this as a way to train students actually to just really develop the muscle memory about how to draw. And we use it for a slightly different reason. So a blind contour portrait is one where you're looking at someone else, you don't take your eyes off of them, and you don't look down at the paper while you're drawing their face, and you don't lift your pen from the paper. And so you're going to end up with something that does not look exactly like their face. And usually it's pretty funny and this wild abstraction, like a cubist representation. And often what happens is that people realize, oh, they wanted to look down at the paper. They wanted to get it right. And other people realize, because I'm embarrassed, I don't want people to think I don't know how to draw, or I don't know how to draw and I'm embarrassed about that. And whatever is coming up for you during that 1 minute exercise is usually a really great clue to what your inner critic is focused on. So part of it is just, what does your inner critic care about? What is she or he telling you in your brain that's stopping you from taking that next creative action? And I'll tell you, my inner critic was alive and well as I was going through the writing process for this book. And I had to learn, I couldn't just ignore it. I had to say, oh, critic, what are you so concerned about? And I would write down the things that were coming to mind that felt really critical, and then I would put them away. And for me, it was actually when I figured out I got to write it down, and then I can see what the patterns are, and then I can figure out how do I deal with that later on in my process. So instead of not getting any words down, I can get some words down and then come back and be in a more critical or evaluative frame of mind later on.
So great you could do that. And we talk about that a lot in mindfulness. And I saw so many intersections in a lot of these exercises and a lot of your narrative related to mindfulness. For example, some of the big chapter categories were seeing things in a new way, making sense of your insights, telling a compelling story, locating your voice, slowing down and focusing. You had so many great categories with different exercises that I think really could help with inspiring us to be more self-aware and mindful and creative, which is, of course, your objective.
The most specific intersection of mindfulness, I think, in creative work is being mindful of your process. Every person has their own creative process, whether that's about where your inner critic lives or what you like to do to prepare when you have to tackle a big creative task. And it is that awareness that does help you set the right conditions for yourself to produce creatively, or set the conditions for your team to work in a creative and collaborative way, or reset the conditions so that person who's that skeptic that you have to convince can start to come along on the journey. I strongly resonate with what you're saying, that mindfulness, in our case, mindfulness of process or self-awareness, it is a really critical aspect to getting to have more control over your creative abilities.
You have an exercise called the Banana Challenge, helping you explore your own creativity and personal experience. But will you share that one? I want to ask you to talk about a few of these exercises that I've pulled out, but also some of your favorites.
I would love to. Yeah. So the Banana Challenge is created by a faculty member at the D School named Thomas Both. And he is a really gifted designer and a really deep thinker. And one of the things that he has zeroed in on is that everybody has their own hobby or obsession. And actually, that's kind of a source of where some of your most interesting ideas might come from. And this is an exercise, the Banana Challenge, in really leveraging that. So it's an activity in which you essentially put yourself in the shoes of an advertiser and you come up with a visual advertisement to sell more bananas. And you literally take a banana and you have to create some advertising material around it. But you have to use whatever your personal obsession is. So the example that's illustrated in the book is a scuba diver who's scuba diving amongst many bananas. That's my personal obsession. So our illustrator was able to incorporate that. But you might be obsessed with old radios, or you might be obsessed with the natural world, or you might be obsessed with your children or with the Olympics, for example. Like, everybody has their own passions. And sometimes what happens in creative work is that we forget that those things are what make our particular contribution really special and really different from what other people might have to bring to the table. And so the banana challenge is about challenging yourself to dig deep into that space that you are really familiar with, and you have your own personal spin on, your own personal point of view about, and use that to do this fun and playful exercise around selling bananas. But once you started to explore that personal territory about what your obsession is, you'll see the link to how it might fuel more unusual, more original, more personal and authentic ideas that only you could come up with.
So cool. And then you have another exercise called the micro mindfulness exercise that inspires a creative mindset.
Yes. So these were developed by a group of folks, including Leticia Britos-Cavagnaro, and really pulling from a number of different mindfulness practitioners. So this is a great set of activities to do over the course of a week. There's one per day. You can do it in the morning and then reflect a little bit on what happened later on in the day. So one of them is around the mindfulness of what's called the mindfulness of doors or spaces, where every time you walk through a doorway, you just take a moment to pause and think about the space that you're leaving and the space that you're entering. There's another exercise that's about smiling. And it's just about the small attention to having a smile on your face as you walk through the world, and then noticing what is that change in yourself? What is that change in other people you encounter, if anything? And these, amongst a few others, are very small actions that you can take to slightly step outside of your normal way of operating. The other one that I love is about being intentional about keeping your phone in your pocket when you're standing in a line. So for the whole day, whenever you're standing in a line, make sure you don't get on your phone. And that is like, first of all, that's hard to do because we're so accustomed to pulling out the phone. But that's why I think it's harder these days to daydream. There's just, we don't have a lot of space. And frankly, many of us are so busy, there's not going to be a ton of space available. So why waste that moment when you're waiting in a line on anything other than allowing your mind to wander, allowing those daydreams to come back and repopulate your creative self? So that's actually, of the different mindfulness activities in that assignment, I love that one the most.
Do you think that, back to that standing in the line exercise, people are so busy, they're staying distracted with their phone because if they were to let their minds wander, they might not be daydreaming, they might be ruminating and need distraction. So how do you move your brain into that daydream mode? Is it the observation of what's in and around you?
I'll actually say there's another great assignment that is specifically about moving yourself into that zone past rumination and into something a little more free. And I'll talk about that just in one second. I think sometimes a little rumination might be the gateway. If you've got something your brain is consciously working out, just observe that that's what's going on in your brain. And I think as you soften and let go of the grip of what of trying to think about a particular thing, I think that is then what may allow you to open up and get into that daydream space. I'll just say that although I absolutely love podcasts and music, if I have a really thorny problem that I'm trying to work on, when I'm commuting, I will intentionally not listen to anything. And at first, like, my brain is whirring and whizzing. And then it just somehow, I'll see something out the window or notice some other car and something happens and I get more into that daydreamy space. And often then I get really interesting ideas related to my original problem or not. But I've found that I do have to go through those initial stages of decompressing and letting off whatever pressure is going on in there. And then I can access that deeper space.
That makes so much sense. There's a quote, it might not be exact, but in the course of your lifelong journey of expanding your creative capacity, you will experience many feelings, both highs and lows. Knowing what triggers these and how your behaviors intersect with the feeling around you will help you get better at setting the conditions that allow for both intellectual and emotional engagement with the work that you're doing. I loved that. I also think of that a lot about developing resilience and equanimity. And you talk about design thinking helping to develop resilience. So how does that work?
I think that there is a part of creative work that is often really challenging and sometimes doesn't actually feel that great. And for some people, that's the experience of getting stuck. For other people, it's when you're trying to figure out which is the direction that I want to pursue in my work. For others, that might be, how is this good enough? Does it measure up? Does it really solve the problem? What are people going to think about or judge me for if I share this work? So I think that there is something very powerful around recognizing that no creative journey just goes in an upward straight line. It really takes you on a roller coaster. And one of the things that I found very powerful when I was a student was just having a more experienced mentor really say to me, that is normal. That is to be expected. And even more than that, if you're not having some of those low moments, you're probably working on something that's like a little bit too safe. If you can see your way straight through to the end solution at the beginning, you're not going to be learning a lot as you go. You're not going to be stretching your abilities. And that really helped me understand what I was experiencing, because I was at a very low moment where I was really worried that the project I was working on just wasn't coming out the way I wanted. And it got me out of that space of anxiety and just helped me get back to the work. So I think there is something to just normalizing that you will feel, although you want equanimity, having some experiences of being out of sorts or being not in equilibrium are actually part and parcel of working in a creative way or in a creative space. That concept, I want to reclaim that. And there is actually a name for this, which I talk about a little bit in the book, which is called productive struggle. And productive struggle is an idea I've borrowed from the field of mathematics education. And it's based on research that shows that when students are given some math problem to be working on, the students who actually struggle a bit at first and don't get it right away, they are much more likely to retain that information longer, to be able to transfer that knowledge to other kinds of contexts and problems. That is actually, I think, some of what happens when you have those moments of struggle in any creative work. It's like, that's a sign that you're learning. And that's part of what you want in any good challenge, is that you are challenged and you are growing as a part of it.
Is there a moment where I have actually two questions about that? Is there a moment where you have certainty that you should abandon a project if there's too much struggle? And this is a completely different question, but maybe you can weave it in, this idea of inspiration versus confidence and this idea of just showing up for the problem.
Yeah, I mean, there is a framework that you can use to think about when you're tackling a problem, which is about, is this something that's just out of my reach? And if I stretch and if I get some help, I actually could achieve it and accomplish it. And the name for that is a wonky name. It's called the zone of proximal development. And it's this idea that it's just a little bit out of reach, but you can get there. But then beyond that, there's the zone where you actually don't quite yet have the right skills. And if you try to work in that zone, you actually are not quite ready for it and you will experience a lot of frustration and anxiety. So learning what's right on the edge of your own abilities, you want to push there, but not actually stretching so far and getting so far out over your skis that you do have to abandon something. So thinking about, how do I tackle a project that's a little bit of a push, but I know I can do pieces of it well. That, I think, is one way to stay within that zone of proximal development. I like your question. I'm thinking about that balance of, what did you say, inspiration?
Inspiration and confidence.
And confidence, yeah.
You said being stuck is often the result of a lack of either inspiration or confidence. Inspiration abounds. Confidence you must build from the inside.
Yes. To me, this is all about, what is it that you need to keep going in your process? And I think that there are so many examples around us in the world of things that could be inspiring. In some cases, there's an overwhelming amount of external inspiration. But the confidence part, no one can just hand that to you. And so I think for many students that I've worked with, the harder thing for them to achieve is that confidence. And one of the ways that we support their development is that we just start out with very small, much more structured or scaffolded projects. And if you get a little bit of confidence that you can do a little bit more than you thought you could, you actually will start to build towards those more greater and greater challenges. So I think that when folks are feeling like, I could never take that on, the best thing to do is just to try a little piece of it, because you might be surprised. It might be counterproductive to try all of it at once or to sign up for that. It's like the same reason that people will sign up for a 5K before they sign up for a marathon. It's like, you're not in shape. You haven't trained for it. But if you do run a little bit further or a little bit faster than you ever knew that you could, you might actually be inspired to try that next larger project or that next longer race. So I think there's something a little bit in our culture where we think about like either you're creative or you're not creative, and it's some kind of binary. And I really reject that. I really don't think that's the case. But I do think that people need to learn that you can build the confidence and you can build the competence by working, like working out your creative skills. And that's actually what will help you then be prepared to take on those bigger challenges.
When you're doing a workshop or a course for your students, do you find that a lot of emotions or mental health issues come up? Because some of this content is so thought-provoking and it's so inspiring on so many levels, but I just wonder if you're inspiring your students to really go much more deeply into their own introspective selves than they've ever gone before. Do you find that, or is that too heavy?
Yes, you're really onto something there. I mean, if you're truly accessing that part of your human capacity for creativity, you are going to really have some struggles along the way. And that manifests in a couple of ways. So it can manifest in conflict within a team. And a lot of our students are like, they just want to get the work done. They want to finish the project. And one of the things that we do support them with is like, hey, how do you work it out when you have team dynamics issues that arise? Because one person is feeling not supported and other people are feeling like they just want to get to the finish line. What do you actually do to strengthen the team dynamic in that moment? So that's one place where we really actively lean in. And I'll also say that we ask our students to tackle challenging problems. And so sometimes if you are really developing empathy for somebody who you're interviewing, who is having a difficult time or struggling themselves, your not just empathy, but like compassion and your own sensitivity to those issues, particularly if you've experienced anything similar, might really come up. So I'll give you one concrete example. We had a class a few years ago that was working on designing ways to help people navigate the healthcare system. And in particular, they were working with the Veterans Hospital, the VA in Palo Alto, around better serving veterans who were experiencing mental health issues. And one of the faculty on that team works at the Stanford Hospital. I think he's a professor of psychiatry. And he really said to the students, I am available for you to talk to if you are encountering in your interviews or through this project challenging emotions, or you really want to talk about something you heard from one of the people you've interviewed. You're not alone in this. These are difficult issues. They may trigger mental health experiences or issues that you are struggling with. And that is important to attend to. And so we never want to put our students in a position where they're out there on their own and struggling. And really, to have these strong connections on these difficult issues, they are going to have some of those feelings. So we want to make sure that we're creating the right environment for them to figure out how to navigate through that work. And it's important work. And so I'm glad that they're able to show up and do it. But we also definitely want them to feel safe and to be safe while they're doing it.
Yeah. And especially since there's so much that you talk about that involves being centered in your emotional self, being empathetic, being compassionate. It's at the heart of a lot of these exercises. I want to see if there are any other exercises or your favorite tips for staying inspired and curious.
I'll come back to the one that I was going to touch on earlier, which is one of my favorites. It's called the dérive. So it comes from a French word that means drift. And that is really the spirit of this activity. So you pick a quality. You're going to go on a walk and you'll bring a notebook. And you pick a quality that you want to follow, and that's going to dictate how you take your walk. So you might choose to follow the color blue, and you see a blue object and you go over and you investigate it. Maybe you make a little sketch in your notebook, and then you look for the next thing that's blue, and then you go over there and you follow it. And you wind up taking this incredible walk that you couldn't have planned because you're drifting, but you're drifting with intention. And I had people follow shadows and light. I've had people follow straight lines. I've had people follow different senses like smells. And what happens when you're doing this is something quite magical, which is that you start noticing things that you never usually notice. And that might be like you're in a familiar place and you're really literally noticing objects or aspects of the environment that you walk by every day that you never see. Or you might be in a new place and you're just noticing a part of the environment that usually is not something you would pay attention to. And one of the things that this activity is just so useful for is helping us recognize the degree to which we're constantly filtering out a lot of the information that's around us, which is just something natural that your brain does so that you're not overloaded. But being able to selectively turn that filter off or turn it into a different kind of a filter, it helps to realize how there are so many opportunities and so many sources of inspiration that are really hiding in plain sight. And that is just a powerful skill to be able to turn on at will. So the Derive is one of my absolute favorites. And Carissa Carter, who is the person who brought this to the D School, she really says, this is the number one thing that I help my ask students to do if they're ever feeling stuck. Nobody comes back from a Derive still feeling stuck.
It's so interesting that that's one of your favorites as a photographer, because that has to be the mindset that you go out with sometimes.
That's right. That is exactly when you're trying to create an image. You're trying to bring something to life with emotion, but you're doing it in an inherently visual medium. And so it's that connection between like, can I express visually what this feels like or what this makes me think about? And I think those skills are really connected. So just that art of noticing what's there is always the beginning of any good photograph.
Yeah. There are over 80 exercises in this book. I could go on and on and on. But tell us some of your favorite tips for staying or becoming more inspired and curious.
I really think that curiosity is stimulated when you try new things. So in a way, it's almost hard for me to say to people, like, here's the one you should do to stay curious. Because I actually think that if you're already, maybe you're already a photographer and you're great at noticing things around you, then I would say, pique your curiosity by trying one of the assignments in here that is about building something. Maybe that's not the normal way you challenge yourself. So in that case, I might suggest you do an assignment called Protobot, in which you gather some simple materials or art supplies, and then you build these little absurdist prompts that actually come from a little computer program that one of our designers, Molly Claire Wilson, created. And Protobot just gets you to create these, a park bench that creates harmony, or a scarf that must be used by 20 people, like really silly, fanciful things. But it just gets you building in a medium that you might not be used to working with. So that's great if what you need is a push in that direction. For other folks, it might be that they already are great at building, but they always get stuck building their ideas in just one medium. So for my students, a lot of times it's they always want to build an app, or they always want to build something in a digital environment. And sometimes I'm like, no, build it in a physical way. So there's a great assignment in here called Solutions Tic-Tac-Toe, which just gets you to think about, what if I made this an experience? What if this thing that I'm trying to create was a service? What would it look like? And it forces you to go through a bunch of different versions of your core idea. And that helps you stretch in all these different ways. So I think for me, what I hope people get out of this book is something that is right for them at the moment. And I'll say that there's a regular table of contents that says, here are all the assignments and their sequence. But there's also a section which is about finding your own path. And so whether you are thinking about, I am great at reflection, as you said, but I really need to figure out, how do I inject some like rapid thinking? There's a whole section that's about how do you pick up the pace? And for other people who maybe have that more serious bias, there's a whole section that's just about having fun and building community and building trust with the people that you work with. So I hope it's just a wide range of different kinds of approaches that will appeal to people, no matter where you are at the moment in your own creative work.
Yeah, I absolutely think it will. And I also wrote down that you say that the design thinker's superpower is navigating ambiguity, but that the underlying goal is really falling in love with ambiguity. So I love that.
I think a lot of us have a complicated relationship with ambiguity. It can feel like, oh, too many options, too many choices. What am I going to do? What's the answer? There's just no way around it, that for real creative work to emerge, you have to wade into that ambiguity. And then you actually learn if there's ambiguity involved, it means that I have an opportunity to really make something special because the conclusion is not foregone. The solution is not obvious. And so figuring out, as you said, we do want people to fall in love with ambiguity a little bit and not to fear it, not to try to constrain the ambiguity in a creative project, because really that's where a lot of the opportunity comes from.
Yeah. It is a really amazing book. I loved it. I highly recommend it. And thank you so much for writing it. It's so cool to bring the things that you're doing out into the world so we can all experience it.
Oh, thank you so much. I really just had so much fun working on this. And it's like, I hope that people get as much out of actually trying out these assignments and playing with these concepts as I did in writing it. It was really a pleasure. And I should say that these assignments are drawn not just from my own teaching practice, but from many, many different people who have been teaching at the D School over the past 10 or so years. And so it was also the experience of bringing the wisdom and inspiration of a whole community of amazing creative educators into the pages of this book. And so I hope people just get a ton from it.
I'm sure they will. Thank you again, Sarah, so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much to Sarah for joining us today. You can pick up a copy of the book at all major booksellers. And for more about Sarah and Stanford's D School, head over to dschool.stanford.edu. And don't forget to check out Muse at choosemuse.com. As always, to give us feedback or to suggest a guest, send us an email at untangle@choosemuse.com. We will see you next week.